Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
In Ukraine, Russia is threatening to make a major strategic breakthrough across the fragile front line as concern grows amongst Western leaders about Donald Trump's plans to, as he said, end the war in 24 hours. This follows reports that Ukraine could develop a rudimentary nuclear bomb if Donald Trump withdraws US military assistance. That's according to a paper prepared by a Ukrainian military think tank for the country's Ministry of Defense. Well, let's take a closer look at what's happening. I'm joined on the line by James Waterhouse, Ukraine correspondent with the BBC, and also Hamish de Breton Gordon, who's a former British Army officer and NATO nuclear defence commander. And thank you both for joining us. James, to begin with you, last month President Zelensky said he told Donald Trump that Ukraine would need nuclear weapons to guarantee his country's security if it were prevented from joining NATO. And President Putin has demanded that Ukraine be prevented from joining NATO. With this impending transition of power in the United States, what immediate impact do you think we've seen on the war in Ukraine?
Well, I think we've seen a continuation of a trend in the sense of Russia continuing to press on multiple parts of the front line. We're not just talking about the eastern city of Pokrovsk. We're talking about Kupiansk in the northeast. We're talking about the Ukrainian offensive inside Russia in the Kursk region. We're talking about Kharkova in the southeast. And so, you know, we've seen a flurry of diplomats in Kyiv, American diplomats trying to max out, if you like, on the outgoing Biden administration. But at the moment, we are still in a period of the unknown. I think, you know, many will hear would have been watching the comments of Donald Trump in Florida yesterday, where he talked about the war having to stop. So clearly he is still intent on trying to bring the war to an end. But we just don't know. We've seen President Zelensky very much in pitch mode, trying to sell the merits of supporting Ukraine in this war, but also the economic opportunities there with investments, with its own natural resources, for example, and, you know, the merits of providing military aid where equipment is tested on the battlefield. But I think until his inauguration, Ukraine is having a very nervous wait as to what he means by having this war to stop.
And then, Hamish, we had this veiled threat almost that Ukraine might be able to develop a rudimentary nuclear bomb if Donald Trump withdraws US military assistance. Now, this was according to a briefing paper which was prepared for the Ukrainian Ministry of Defence. But in your view, how realistic a prospect is that?
Well, good morning, Claire. You know, without going into massive details, certainly with plutonium spent fuel that Ukraine has in abundance, with the latent knowledge that they probably have. Remember, they had nuclear weapons until 1994 when US and Russia agreed to take them away but protect Ukraine. So they probably got the know-how to do it. And as the paper says, they could probably produce a small atomic device that would have a yield of about 1 to 2 kilotons, which is 1,000 or 2,000 tons of commercial explosives. So, but I think, as you suggest, this is very much maneuvering, sort of 8 weeks until Trump comes to power. And I'm sure Zelensky, and I'm sure we all want to see Ukraine in the best possible position, because if a ceasefire is forced on them, Zelensky wants to be on the front foot, not the back foot. So, and also just a final bit, the paper also talks about these weapons being used to take out airfields. But at the same time, these airfields just over the boundary into Russia could also be taken out by Storm Shadow Attackums and Taurus long-range missiles, which Zelensky desperately wants the permission to be able to use over the border. And if he could, he might well get on the front foot by the 20th of January.
So the nuclear threat you see as a bargaining chip being used by Zelensky as the clock ticks down to Trump taking over?
Yes, I think it is, because, of course, you know, the second and third order consequences of Ukraine using a nuclear weapon in Russia or even against Russian troops in occupied Ukraine, you know, one would expect Russia to respond in kind with much more, which then could escalate into a wider nuclear conflict. So I think it's a good idea. You know, certainly they have the wherewithal to do it. And it's got everybody listening, which I think Zelensky wants, because as James says, we're in this sort of funny sort of situation of almost the turn of the tide. Nothing's really moving. But for Zelensky and the Ukrainians, they have got to do as much as they can in the next 8 weeks to get on the front foot. And this, to me, is a pretty good way of getting there.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable and correct, doesn't it, James? That, you know, Zelensky and Ukraine just want the focus to be on them now and this problem and where it might go if Donald Trump does what they fear most, which is try and cut a deal with Russia.
I think we shouldn't miss the point that this is an incredibly difficult period for Ukraine, and I agree this is a moment of political significance for President Zelensky. The conditions are deteriorating. We're in the very much in the rainy season. There's been snow over the past couple of days. So if you're talking about a side wanting to recapture territory and mount a counteroffensive, that's just not going to happen. The tide is very much going in Russia's favor. So okay, if the president-elect comes in, Donald Trump, and imposes a form of ceasefire, where does the compromise come for Ukraine? Even if the conflict is frozen, Russia occupies a fifth of the country. It has not slowed in its ambition of trying to take as much as possible. And there are a sequence of very nervous cities in eastern Ukraine watching nervously, Pokrovsk, Kostantinivka, Kramatorsk, all waiting to see what might come over the hill if Ukrainian forces continue to be overstretched, and especially if American help is further jeopardized. But even if Donald Trump was to say, right, we'll keep supporting you for as long as it takes, that does not solve Ukraine's problems with serious manpower issues and Russia only demonstrating that it can continue to add soldiers to its fight and exercising its superior manpower reserves.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the importance of Kursk, and you know who holds Kursk by Christmas is seen as a very important factor in where this goes from here.
For sure. I mean, I think when it first happened and we were all scratching our heads to try and work out why Ukraine mounted this offensive, clearly they were hoping to use this as leverage for a future peace negotiation. That was part of it. Another benefit which has been realized is prisoner of war exchanges. The Ukrainians captured a lot of Russian soldiers, and that's been leveraged accordingly. It was also hoped that it would make Russia pull its own soldiers from other parts of Ukraine to relieve pressure on the front lines. And there is a growing consensus that that has not happened. Russia has gathered, it's thought, 50,000 troops. A portion of those are from North Korea in the Kursk region, and Ukraine is slipping its foothold there. So if Ukraine was to pull out, which I think will happen at some point, and the only benefit is a few prisoner of war exchanges, then you could argue that it has not been worth it. It's only of value for Ukraine if it's able to say, okay, if you're not going to surrender what you've captured on our territory, we'll keep hold of Kursk. If that slips away, then the merits and the costs of the Kursk offensive will be closely examined, you think, in the future.
Hamish, do you think that Kursk is very critical to Ukraine in all of this?
I do, absolutely. And my piece in the I paper yesterday really reiterated this. I see it as vital ground. If Ukraine still holds a reasonable amount of Kursk by Christmas, I think they're in a good position. Kursk is hallowed ground for the Russians. It's where the Russians defeated the Nazis, or certainly turned the Second World War back in 1943. So to have lost that ground, you know, admittedly, it's not a huge area. It's still sort of 1,000+ square kilometres, so it's significant. If they can hold that, the British and military intelligence update earlier this week says that the Russians are losing 2,000 soldiers a day in Kursk. You know, 50,000 soldiers is about a month's worth. So, you know, even the great Russian army and the ability to get troops even from places like North Korea, you know, that is difficult to maintain that element of human destruction. So I think Kursk is really important. As James says, it was there as a bargaining chip. If they can still hold what they're holding now at Christmas and coming into power, then I think that'll be significant leverage. If they lose it, I think they will be on the back foot. So it's back foot, front foot. Kursk is key.
Well, you say too that Britain and France will be critical when it comes to an outcome here. Do you say that they will be critical if the US does, as we think Donald Trump might do, withdraw at least some support, stop them from joining NATO and try to cut a deal with Vladimir Putin? Or regardless, do you see Britain and France being critical in the outcome, even if the United States continues to support Ukraine?
Well, absolutely. There are lots of scenarios that we just don't know are going to play out. But certainly Britain and France, you know, we have the military heft and the know-how. And let's face it, I was talking to an American channel earlier on today. They are 4,000 miles further west than we are, you know, and Trump has a point in a way. You know, this is up to Europe. The reason Putin invaded on the 24th of February 2022 is that he looked west and didn't see a conventional deterrence, military deterrence that's going to stop him. And it's up to us to make sure that in future that we do have a military deterrence that will stop any Russian advance in future. But until we're in a position where there is a peace and a ceasefire, it's absolutely behest on the nuclear NATO members of Europe, which is us and the French, to lead the way. We've got the Finns and the Swedes, their massive armies holding the sort of northern flank, if you like. But it's critical, I think, in the fact that some of the other big countries like Germany are not bending their back as perhaps we'd hope. Obviously, the Poles are really going at it, because I think nobody believes that if Putin prevails in Ukraine and if he's sitting in Kyiv this time next year, you know, the Baltic states reckon that they're next, and I'm pretty sure that they're right. So we've got an opportunity to make sure that we secure a peace for Ukraine on its terms next year. And if we don't, you know, God knows what's going to play out.
And James, do you get a real sense of fear and anxiety now in Ukraine around what Donald Trump might do, and a sense that the clock is really ticking for them until he takes office?
I do. I mean, we were at a flat last week where a Russian drone had collided through the window, killing a 14-year-old girl. And we were speaking to their parents in such a scene of concentrated devastation. And they said, look, this war is tiring, you know, for obvious reasons. And they questioned, they couldn't fathom the logic of it. They said, you know, territorial economy, you know, no one benefits was the overarching argument. And when you're in eastern Ukraine, there are those who've seen so much death and destruction that yearn for an end, a respite, and a respite quickly. And they see Donald Trump as possibly a path to that. But the majority view is an anxious outlook on what it could mean for the future of the country. Because, of course, we talk about ceasefires, don't we? A negotiation, a line in the sand. For Ukraine, it's much more binary. And it really is seen as that. Because if there is a ceasefire, Russia has broken countless ceasefires over the last 11 years of war. Russia, it is viewed very strongly here, will remain on a war footing with its economy. Vladimir Putin will set his sights, as Hamish is saying, on the whole of Ukraine, that hasn't suddenly gone away. And then Donald Trump, the West, they look elsewhere. They look at the war in the Middle East. They look at more domestic issues. And Ukraine is overwhelmed eventually after putting up the extraordinary fight it has. So there is an anxiety. There is still a desire to fight. But the nature of wars is thus that, you know, Ukraine is struggling to mobilize enough men to fight. There are men now petrified of being called up. And there are very difficult conditions on the front line that most are all too aware of. So I think it really is a difficult juncture for Ukraine. Yeah. Which way do you turn? Do you continue to fight, or do you, you know, ultimately the end point of this war isn't in Ukraine's hands, and that is of enormous frustration in Kyiv.
All right. Well, we are certainly entering a critical period, and that's clear from what both of you have told us, James Waterhouse and Hamish de Breton-Gordon. Now, I just want to tell you what we have coming up in the next hour. We're expecting some political fireworks because climate change fines could cost us dearly if we don't meet our targets. So what are the people who are vying for your vote going to do about it? Join us for the climate change election debate here after 11. We will also be hearing about Katie Taylor stepping back into the ring in Texas tonight. So can Ireland's best defeat Amanda Serrano again? That's all on the way. Right now, though, we'll take a quick break.
Text
51551. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.